paper.
Welcome to episode 67 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. Today, I'm talking with Nicole Donnelly, a hand papermaker and visual artist specializing in sculptural paper artworks and invasive plant papers. She is currently president of the International Association of Hand Papermakers and Paper Artists, also known as IAPMA, and the founder of the creative papermaking studio Paper Think Tank in Philadelphia. Donnelly is also a master papermaker for the Brodsky Center at PAFA and the Brandywine Workshop and Archives. She teaches paper and book arts at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art and other institutions. She received her MFA from the University of Iowa in 2009 and a BA from Bennington College. She has received grants and fellowships to complete a number of international residencies, and her artwork has been exhibited throughout the United States and internationally. Enjoy our conversation. Nicole Donnelly, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Helen.
Yeah, it's great to have you, and let's dive right in. So tell me a little bit about where you grew up and childhood activities that were art-related or even paper-related. I don't know if you had
any. So I grew up in Philadelphia. I'm from Philadelphia, PA. And, you know, I really didn't have much of an introduction to the fine arts, but I always grew up, my grandmother taught me to sew when I was five, and I was always really compelled to draw and make things, and I think one of my earliest artworks was sort of taking all of these fake flowers that had fallen off of some fancy hat that my great aunt had given me, and gluing those down to a sheet of paper, gluing down a ribbon over it, and I had made this garden, and I drew trees around it, and that was my very first artwork.
I love it.
Yeah, but I've always really loved paper as a material, and it's something that's come up as this very tactile thing throughout my life. And, you know, I have to say that I probably took it for granted for some time. And it wasn't until I was living in Mexico in the early 2000s. And I had studied visual art in college. I studied painting and printmaking, you know, and I was familiar with printmaking papers, I thought, standard printmaking, you know, BFK, some of the Japanese papers, but I really didn't have that much of a perspective into the wide variety of papers that you do have. And I was living in Mexico City after I graduated from college, and printmaking is just so much more a part of the culture in Mexico than, say, painting. So when you go to the art store, they don't have, you know, one island of flat files with drawers of paper or one wall with papers that you can feel and touch. It was aisles. Aisles of paper. And
wow.
You know, the Amate papers, all different styles, all different colors. Papers from Germany, papers from France, and I mean, just floor to ceiling, three aisles of paper. My mind was blown.
Wow. Yeah. Let's back up a little bit. So why did you end up, you went to college to study art and you went to Bennington College, right?
Yes, I did. I did.
And so what drove you to study art?
Well, I think I had always really loved drawing and painting, and I pursued art in high school, but I went to an all-girl Catholic high school. And they have some rigid ideas about what is art, and my teacher did not like the kinds of things that I made because I consistently would do the assignment, make something that looked like something else, make a representational drawing, painting, but then I would take at least one element and just totally change it from what it should be to closely represent what the thing was that I was actually looking at, you know, and whether that was changing color or proportion or something like that, I would make these wild, I just used air quotes, changes to the thing that I was making, and my teachers didn't like it. When I got to college, I didn't think I was going to pursue art. I had also done a lot of theater and studied music in high school, so by the time I got to college, I went into theater, and I was studying acting and playwriting, but it wasn't necessarily the best fit for myself at the time. And I realized that after doing an internship in New York City that I really didn't like actors, which too bad for me. But I found them to be some of the most vain individuals I had met. And that specifically, you know, Broadway district in New York. And that's a very specific type of acting that happens. But in my second semester, I ended up, you know, I thought it would be really great to just try painting in oil because I had only worked in acrylic up until that point, all through high school. And I thought, you know, Bennington, this is a wild and free place. I'm pretty sure I won't be so outlandish here. And sure enough, I started painting with oil, and I really fell in love with the medium. I mean, it's still a love of mine. I love the way that oil paint smells. Its color remains true. And that's, you know, I have a very deep appreciation for color and how color vibrates. And as a visual artist, that's just so important to everything that you're doing. And by changing the relationship of one color next to another, you can dramatically change the feeling of a composition without having changed the composition at all. And so that was, you know, that was just this huge realization for me. And that is what set me on the path of being an artist, really, was the encouragement from my one professor, Pam, who's a phenomenal painter herself. And I really love, she has a brilliant sense of color, and I think she imparted that to a lot of us.
And so you said, studied painting and printmaking, and then what took you to Mexico after college?
Well, I had a boyfriend at the time, and actually, directly after college, we had moved to Vancouver, BC.
Okay.
And his sister was living there, and she was running a contemporary art gallery, but had zero experience doing that. But she had the money to do it, and she had the connections with all of the artists there. So we started. It was meant to be a for-profit gallery space, but we operated it as a nonprofit. I was the only person who had any experience working in a gallery. And I ended up working there for a year and a half. But because I was with this boyfriend who was born in Mexico and essentially had overstayed a student visa, we decided to move to Mexico. After a year and a half, the gallery was starting to peter out. It was obvious that it wasn't going to make any money. we had to make a decision about whether or not to formally become a nonprofit or if that was just really too much work. And ultimately, it was Alejandra's decision, so she decided not to continue. And we moved to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And Mexico City was just, I mean, it's a city of 20 million people. And Mexico City is just incredibly colorful, literally colorful. The colors of the buildings, the way that grout is applied to stone walls, you know, all of the signage is hand painted. It's just this visually rich experience. The taxi cabs are lime green, you know, they're these VW bugs that are painted lime green and white. It's just so visually stimulating. And I really had a great time while I was living.
Yeah. And so how long did you live there? And were you painting and doing printmaking?
So I lived there for 6 months consecutively. And I had gone to visit a few times before that, for about a month or so, three or four times before that. So, you know, altogether a very short period, but it was the very first studio that I had. So the apartment building that we found had these rooftop maid quarters. And the maid's quarters were really not used by anyone any longer. So tenants used them for storage mostly. They were these, most of the buildings in Mexico are concrete. So our apartment building was this big concrete building. And the apartments on top were these concrete rooms with one or two windows, no electricity. and I rented the maid's quarter on the rooftop of our building. It had two big windows, beautiful light. It was, you know, just a small room, but that was my very first art studio outside of school. And I spent every afternoon there. So I would go to work in the morning. I worked at this organic grocer. That is where I learned most of my Spanish, learning the words for produce. So, you know.
Yeah.
Lechuga. ¿Qué es lechuga? Yes. but yeah, it was just such an incredible time. And I worked for an architect, and between those two jobs sort of made ends meet. And then I, you know, ran out of my visitor's visa, the relationship split up, and I moved back to Philadelphia.
Okay. What did you do for the architect? I'm just curious because I wanted to be an architect and I never followed through.
Well, so the interesting thing, I think in American culture, we have these very distinct slots that people sort of fit into. And so an architect does this one very specific thing in the U.S. And in other countries, that's not always the case. So the architect oftentimes, you know, not only designs the building and consults with the structural engineer to make sure that that building won't fall down, but the architect will often design all of the interior spaces. The architect will, down to the, you know, the type of furniture that goes in it, the textiles that cover those pieces of furniture, the floors, the curtains. It's really this very holistic approach, so that the architect is the interior designer as much as the exterior designer. And my job was textile design. So that was a really interesting thing to try and put together compelling designs that oftentimes were based on, you know, a couple of ideas and one sketch that the architect gave me. And, you know, I could use Photoshop, and then we were also using the software that would translate the design from Photoshop into a textile. Embroidery machines, which are really neat.
Okay. So then you moved back to Philadelphia, and what happened next? I know eventually you went to graduate school.
Right. So I spent 2 years abroad after college and then 2 years back in Philadelphia. And that was really just a period of getting my feet under me. And I think, you know, at the time I was conceiving of grad school as, okay, I definitely could teach. I could teach. That's something that I can do. There's a lot that I, you know, at the time there was quite a lot that I could do, speaking multiple languages and other stuff like that. But teaching felt like the right avenue to put all of those skills. And I thought if I go to grad school, then I'll be able to teach at university. That would be great. And it took me 2 years to save up. After living in Mexico, I was flat broke. In Mexico, no one really has money. And you're all just borrowing it from somewhere and it gets passed around. And it was not unusual to not be paid for the work that you had completed. So it was a little tough, but I spent 2 years in Philadelphia, and that was really when I started to meet people in the art community in my city, because I grew up in the suburbs of the city, still within the city limits, but the suburbs are what I call a culture desert. There is not any sort of habit to go to the museums. If that turns into a 50-minute drive into the city, you have a car, you have, you know, all of the usual excuses that you can make. And you know, there just wasn't a lot of diversity. There wasn't much. And I spent, you know, after 18 years growing up in the suburbs, I ran away. That was what I wanted to get away. And in those 2 years after Mexico City, I really started to learn how much my city had to offer. And it was very eye-opening to return to the place that I had left, not only returning to the United States, which was a huge amount of culture shock.
Yeah.
Coming back in, going to Mexico, you know, I was just exploring and excited, but returning to the U.S. was the culture shock. So I spent 2 years really exploring my city and getting to know the other artists, working for the mural arts program, working as a bartender. It was just a really fun and exciting time because I was about 25, you know, so it's just the whole world feels open and you're an adult for the first time.
Yeah. And so, you were living in the city.
Yes.
Not the suburbs.
Right. So I started off living close to the universities, Drexel and UPenn, near their campus. Mm-hmm. And then I found a better apartment that was over in what's called Fishtown, which is a pretty thriving artistic community. Mm-hmm. And I still live very close to where that first apartment was. But that area of the city has a lot of old industrial spaces because it was a center of the industry. There were textile factories and just warehouses, you know, huge warehouses that have now been converted into artist spaces. Mm-hmm. And it was just a great time. I rented a studio space for $75 a month above a motorcycle garage.
Oh, wow.
My friends had a band, you know, I was in a band. It was all just, it was really fun.
And so the studio space was separate from where you were living?
Yeah.
So you've always kind of had a studio. Yeah.
Yes.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. And I think that was really establishing a studio practice, you know, while even inside of my home, because while I was in Vancouver, we really only had this tiny apartment, but I carved out a space in the kitchen to use as my studio. And that studio practice, I mean, really saved me mentally and emotionally. But I think it was also really crucial that I proved to myself that I would continue making art. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to study it in school.
Right.
And it was a it was an entirely other thing to see almost everyone that I went to school with at Bennington move to New York City. And because New York City was so expensive, you know, this is the early 2000s. New York City was so expensive that you needed two jobs just to pay for your apartment. If you wanted a separate studio space, that was a third job, and there went all of your time.
Right.
No one continued making work.
Right.
So it was really important for me to prove to myself that I could continue doing both things. And I did.
Mm-hmm.
Which was awesome. And, you know, but after a year and a half, you know, I sort of went back, and I'm a journaler. I've kept a journal since I'm 10.
Wow.
which is kind of wild.
Yeah.
But, you know, I went back into my journal, and when I came back from Mexico City, I saw, okay, 2-year goals. One of them is go to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, I'm starting to feel a little bit stuck in my work. You know, I was pushing up against something in my paintings, and it just, everything felt so constricted to the rectangle. And I hated that.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt really stifling. And I thought, okay, grad school is going to be this place where, yes, I'm going to get the degree that lets me teach higher ed, but it's also going to give me this conversation to really break out of what I'm doing and go further with it.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here. And I want to tell you about the Paper Year, which is going online in 2021. This is an annual subscription club, kind of like a year-long online class, featuring a new paper project each and every month. Get inspired with video and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating for the rest of the month. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative environment. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more and hold your spot. Registration opens in late December, and the first project will be delivered on January 4th.
I applied to 3 schools, or maybe just 2 in the end. I forget. Undergrad and grad school, both of them, I applied to very few schools. Mm-hmm. And luckily, I was ignorant enough, naive enough to think that that was okay.
It worked out, but, yeah.
Yeah, it worked out. So, you know, I applied to the University of Iowa based on the recommendation of Ann Peibel, who was my professor from undergrad. And she had gone there and really loved the program.
And this was painting.
This was painting program. Yes. Mm-hmm. So that is the program that I applied to. I also applied to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. I was accepted to both schools, but of course, the Art Institute did not offer me any money. And the University of Iowa said, please come here. We will pay your whole tuition. And
oh, I thought, wow.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And it was 2006 that I entered the University of Iowa, and it was such a beautiful and welcome change. And, you know, living in a dense urban space to just this beautiful, open, Midwestern place that's very small, very easy to get around, but I think everyone hears Iowa and thinks corn, and there's actually a lot more to Iowa and a lot more to Iowa City because, of course, it's a college town, so
right.
There's a thriving music scene, and it draws international students.
Sure.
And it's this wonderful bastion of liberal ideas and just a wonderful community.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I went to visit it for a day and a half, I think, before accepting, accepting admission. And I just thought it was great. Yeah. So let's see.
So yeah. So the program, did you spend 2 or 3 years there?
I spent 3 years.
3 years. Okay.
Three-year program. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that I really love that because going into and coming out of any grad program, you have this first semester of entry where you are just learning where you are and learning who the other people in the program are, who the professors are, what's expected of you, how to get back into this rhythm of school, because I had taken 4 years off, which, mm-hmm. you know, at this point to me, I'm 4 years, that's nothing. But at the time, there were a lot of other students who had moved directly from undergrad into grad. Sure. And I couldn't have imagined doing that because I think coming out of undergrad, first of all, I was fed up with school. But even at a wacky liberal arts place like Bennington, I was fed up with the structure of school and I needed a break. But also taking those 4 years in between really helped me know exactly what I wanted to get out of the experience of grad school.
Sure.
And I think that's essential mm-hmm. because otherwise you don't know why you're there and you're not going to get as much out of that education as you should. And if you know what you're going after, you're going to pursue it much more strongly and you can make informed decisions. That's, you know, oops, that is, that's the biggest thing that I try to encourage in any of my students that I teach now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a 3-year program. You have that first semester of entry, which is getting used to. And I think as you're moving towards graduation, that last semester also gets eaten up. You're thinking about what's next? How am I going to find a job? Where am I moving to? Am I moving? All of those things come into play. And it's very distracting from doing the work that you're there to do. So in a 2-year program, you really have
1 year of, yeah.
One full year of dedicated mm-hmm. brain space. And Iowa gave me 2 years of dedicated mm-hmm. brain space. And that was fabulous because, you know, my work changed so much in those 3 years. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of that time, exactly the halfway point is when I discovered treatment. So that
right.
Was,
so Tim Barrett set up this amazing program at the University of Iowa in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So, how did you learn about the program?
Right. So when I tell people that I went to the University of Iowa, most papermakers look at me like, oh, of course.
You right. did.
But no, I went there for painting. I had no idea the Center mm-hmm. for the Book was there. Although I was familiar with the work of P.J. Smith. And, that was something that had been introduced to me by a friend that I met in Vancouver. So artist books were something that I knew about. And so there were like loosely these connections.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not consciously moving towards any of that. And really the catalyst for moving into paper was that I was making these giant room-sized drawing installations. So drawing directly on the walls with charcoal, 8 feet high, 36 feet long, huge undertaking. And, you know, most of my professors were pretty supportive of it. But there was one who just said, Nicole, these are amazing. It's this huge physical challenge. It's beautiful and ephemeral. It's doing all of these things that you want it to do. However, when you get out of school, no gallery is going to let you do this. They can't sell the work.
Right.
You really need to think about what form this takes. Is it the documentation? Is it, you know, thinking about all of those things, and you should really consider making them on paper and just hanging these sheets of paper. And I looked at her and said, Maggie, I can't find paper that large that feels right, that does what I want it to do, that has the same sort of tactile quality as the charcoal directly on the wall. And, you know, you're thinking about paper in a large roll at that mm-hmm. point when you're thinking about 8 feet and that this drawing is 36 feet long. Okay, so I need at least 9 sheets that are 4 feet wide by 8 right. feet long. Yeah. And what are you going to draw on BFK? Like, that's going to look terrible. Or, you know, the options that I was coming up with were either going to be very expensive to get
right.
this super nice Japanese paper that's just going to be this wonderful veil against the wall. Or not, it wasn't right. And she said, oh, you know, there's a professor here who teaches paper making. His name is Tim Barrett. You could learn how to make any kind of paper you want with him. Even really large paper, and absolutely out of any fiber that you want. Ugh. And so I signed up for his class, and I just fell in love with him. Mm-hmm. I mean, we started by learning Nagashizuki, preparing the kozo, hand beating it, picking out the specs, you know, forming the sheets of paper, and I just found standing at the bat and trying to make a sheet of paper that is the most like paper that paper can be to be such a soothing activity.
Yeah.
For 3 hours, it was just this beautiful silence. And as we started working through Western fibers, I realized that, you know, you could have these beautiful, light Japanese papers, these heavy, weighty Western papers. And every student was required to do beater tests on an assigned fiber. And I had abaca. Mm-hmm. So we were working with unbleached abaca, and you just let it run in the beater, taking out a little cup of pulp, throwing it into a deco box, pull a sample sheet every half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time that abaca was, you know, headed towards 6 hours, I was just getting so excited because, you know, first of all, you're standing there with a deckle box waiting for it to drain for 5 minutes. But that paper was just incredible on the surface of the mold, on the surface of the felt, as it started to air dry. And Anne-Marie Kennedy came to the University of Iowa to do a special weekend workshop. And we worked with high shrinkage flax also.
Mm.
And so then I knew what I needed to do with this paper, and that I could embed imagery directly into the paper was this huge realization. And that for me was this way that everything that was frustrating me in painting mm-hmm. could be incorporated into the paper. And, you know, the paper is also made on a rectangular mold surface most of the time.
Right.
So you have that rectangular form, but the paper is infinitely malleable.
Mm-hmm.
You can work with it while it's wet to change its shape. You can right. overlap the couching to create larger sheets of paper and incorporate things into the paper. It was just, you know, this like hallelujah moment.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. And so did you ever do anything large scale, or did you just kind of, you experienced paper and just went in all different directions? Like the paintings, did that follow through, or? You kind of got taken with paper. The large, the 8-foot by 35-foot rooms that your teacher said, right. oh, you should learn to make paper. Did you ever do anything like that? Or did you just kind of,
you know, move? I never quite translated that mm-hmm. onto paper. But what I did do was, these larger it was a larger triptych. So the sheets were 4x8, mm-hmm. And it was this waterfall imagery. So two of them were unintentional pull paintings because I had zero experience with how to do some of the things that I wanted. So I was reading a description of how to do them, failed miserably. And as an emergency technique, just pigmented all the pulp that I had ruined, this beautiful blue, and put it back into place on the mold surface by hand, instead of making this uniform, beautiful sheet, and made a diptych of a waterfall that was blue and white, and a third sheet that was the same waterfall imagery consolidated onto the one sheet, but with the addition of a plain encaustic wax to create this translucent layer ahead of it. So that was my beautiful sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. The pulp paintings were, you know, not the best sheets of paper, but as a diptych unto themselves, fairly successful. Mm-hmm. And I sold that piece too, so mm-hmm. that was really nice.
Mm-hmm.
But I never went back to that full room
right.
installation. And part of me wishes, well, no, I was done with the idea. Yeah. I had exhausted the idea.
Right.
So I've made other large scale work, but it's never returned back to that.
So did you still get a degree in painting, or did you move over to paper, or how did that sort of
right.
end up?
So I was at the University of Iowa 2006 to 2009. And at the time that I was graduating, the Center for the Book still only issued a certificate in the book. They didn't give you an MFA.
Okay.
And you could do, I think it was, you could do a program where you received your MFA in printmaking or painting, sculpture, and also received a certificate in the book. And if I had pursued that from the beginning, I would have gotten the certificate in those 3 years quite easily, because mm-hmm. I think I was two classes shy of the certificate. I hadn't taken a history of the book, essentially. I had done artist book courses, bookbinding courses, papermaking courses as my electives because I thought they were fun and wonderful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I got to study with wonderful professors there, but I never did study with Gary Frost. Those two last sections for history of the book. So I received my MFA in painting. I do not have a certificate of the book, but I really, my entire thesis was handmade paper. I didn't have any paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And to the credit of the painting faculty, they completely accepted that and were very praising of my work.
And was that work painting related? Was it pulp painting, or was it completely
no.
something else? Okay.
Oh
okay.
Yeah, I think I had very little, aside from that diptych that I
uh-huh.
described,
uh-huh.
I didn't have any work that involved color at all.
Mm-hmm.
My palette had already been reduced to black and white, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I started off coming into Iowa with this very vibrant palette, muted but vibrant, and it just became more and more muted until I was working almost black and white, and working a lot with drawing. Most of the works in paper were embedding fabric, like cheesecloth, and sort of getting these ghostly images in them, and also taking charcoal transfers from the wall drawings. So taking that wet sheet of paper, I would impress it against the wall to pick up the charcoal and stretch it over a frame. And those were the pieces.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So I did translate some of that giant wall drawing, but mostly it's, you know, never to be seen.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. And so then you finished up at Iowa, and what happened next?
And then I returned to Philadelphia. You know, Tim Barrett had invited me and strongly encouraged me to continue at Iowa for that extra semester to do the certificate and work with him at Oakdale. And I turned it down, which in hindsight, I think I would have really liked doing that. And I wish that I had, but one more Iowan winter was, it felt very hard. Negative 30 is not for everyone.
No.
But it's a beautiful place and I love it and I do miss it. So I returned to Philadelphia and what I realized while I was still in Iowa is that a good friend of mine, Mary Tosillo, she and I went to Bennington College together. So we knew each other from there. She was living in Philadelphia. She had been attending the University of the Arts here in Philadelphia at the same time that I was living in Philadelphia for those 2 years before grad school. Mm-hmm. So she was in grad school at UArts studying paper, print, and book. And I didn't really connect that at the time either before I went to Iowa.
Right.
It was not on my mind. But I realized while I was still in Iowa that she was editing the Hand Paper Making newsletter. And so I saw her name attached to that and I thought, oh, right. I need to get in touch with Mary as soon as I'm back so that I can figure out where she's been making paper since she graduated.
Mm-hmm.
Because I assumed that Philadelphia, with this program for paper and book arts, would have somewhere that where you can make paper. I knew about Udonne in New York. I knew about Pyramid Atlantic. And I thought, surely, Philadelphia has paper making. Well, I moved back, and surely it did not. And what I found out from Mary was that the students who graduated from UArts, the grad students who completed the program at UArts were allowed to continue accessing the studio, which was in the basement of the building and kind of dumpy from what I understand and a little gross and creepy. but, you know, they were allowed to continue to use the beater and access the studio when grad students weren't using it. So no one had set up a paper making
studio. Right.
And Winnie Radelin, who taught at UArts for many years, and at that point was still teaching at UArts. She had a beater of her own, but she lives sort of way out in the suburbs, and you know it's not central in any way. And it wasn't. She would open her home studio for workshops, but she wasn't in the habit of loaning out her beater and, you know, all that stuff. So there was no paper making in the city. And in talking with Mary, she said, well, you know, I'm going to the Friends of the Yard Hunter annual conference in October, which at that point was going to be in Atlanta. And she said, oh, you should really consider coming with me. I had no clue about the Friends of the Yard Hunter. Even though I had just been studying paper for the last year and a half.
Oh, interesting. So the Friends of Dart Hunter is now called the North American Hand Paper Makers, and it's organization with 500 members, maybe a national organization. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dedicated to hand paper making. So I thought, okay, this is a good idea. And I just thought it would be great to make some more connections and find out who else was making paper and how they were managing home studios and doing that sort of stuff. So I went to that and I felt like I met my tribe, you know? Mm-hmm. And I remember being so shy, but also excited to meet people. And I know that I stopped at your table and I probably said something dumb and embarrassing where I was like, I know that you've written a book or several.
I don't remember at all. I'm sorry. I was trying to remember whether I was at that conference. So now you're telling me I was. Okay.
You were. So I went to that conference and I felt like I met this wonderful tribe of people who were enthusiastic makers. And I came back to Philadelphia feeling really inspired after that. So I started, what I knew that I could do was process Japanese fibers by hand.
Right.
I didn't need any equipment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can purchase Kozo. And also mulberry, just regular red mulberry and white mulberry grows all over Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I might try harvesting that. You know, we'll see how that goes. Because I think it was also Patterson Clark was possibly at that conference in Atlanta.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Talking about his work with all of these different
invasive plants. Yeah, he lives in the DC area. Yes. And harvests so, all this stuff. Yeah,
right. And his website is such a great resource, Alien Invasives, I think. But that was one that got me started. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to start looking around for where I can cut back some of these things. I know that I don't have to go too far. The neighborhood of Philadelphia that I'm in had, at that point, had a lot of empty lots. So this is 2009. 2020, the area of the city is looking very different and very built up. But there are not many empty lots left in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
But there was mulberry growing out of everywhere. And so I just went two blocks away, cut a bunch of it back, tied it up. And I did this maybe on a Tuesday morning. So people are commuting to work. They're walking past me on their way to the train. And people kept thanking me. And I, at first I thought that was weird because I'm just over here at this empty lot cutting back what everyone else perceives as weeds. And I think I'm using this material for selfish purposes. But meanwhile, people keep walking by and thanking me for clearing the lot.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't, that wasn't an expected thing, but I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've processed some white mulberry, some red mulberry that winter and made some paper from it. I did have an external studio, but it was really gross. So I was making paper at home.
My conversation with Nicole Donnelly ended up being long, so I've broken it into two parts. Don't miss part two, which you'll find soon at helenhebertstudio.com/podcast. And you can also find all 60-plus episodes of Paper Talk over there. Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon. The reason, besides the season.